Thank you so much, Robin, for that wonderful introduction. I did appreciate the introduction. I've had worse. President Clinton once introduced me as the person who typed his speeches, so that was accurate but not complete, at least I think. It is a wonderful thing to be able to be introduced by and share this podium with Robin, who is such a leader on legal, constitutional, and jurisprudential issues on the issue of guns and gun violence, and also to have the chance to talk with Mark, who has been such a pioneering and influential journalist from whom I learn and so many of us learn every day. And it's a thrill for me as a former speechwriter to be here to be part of talking to all of you at the Commonwealth Club. As you may or may not know, but as we had drummed into us repeatedly by President Clinton, the Commonwealth Club is where Franklin Roosevelt set out his vision behind the New Deal in 1932 during the campaign. And we were given instructions repeatedly by President Clinton, read the Commonwealth Club speech. We need a Commonwealth Club speech. So here we are at the Commonwealth Club. What Roosevelt said, and this was at a time of shattering dogmas, was, as he said, new times demand new responses and new approaches from government. And on this issue, I would say that that is as true as it has ever been. I started working on this book in the immediate aftermath of the Newtown shooting, coming as it did, that massacre, that painful, painful story, after too many recent mass shootings. And it was the first time that the country had been riveted on these issues in quite a while. And it was the first time that we were once again debating the laws around guns and what we as a country can do to grapple with gun violence and how to balance rights and responsibilities and the many different factors at play. And it was also the very first time that the debate was happening with the Second Amendment to the Constitution so front and center, so at the heart of what people were arguing, were embracing, were analyzing. So I wanted to understand, in researching and writing this book, how change happens, as FDR described it. How does legal change actually happen in this country? How does constitutional change happen? And how have we changed and come to understand the Second Amendment, what it means, and how has it become so front and center in our debates? So many people, even aficionados, even people who passionately care about this issue, don't realize that it was not until 2008 that the Supreme Court of the United States ever ruled that the Second Amendment recognized an individual right to gun ownership. 2008, very recent. In fact, previously, repeatedly, it had ruled otherwise. And this was the Heller case, District of Columbia versus Heller. And it was written, the majority opinion was written by Justice Antonin Scalia. It was a significant thing for him to write it. And he said that the Heller case reflected the vindication of his judicial philosophy of originalism. The idea, as he has articulated it, that the only legitimate way to understand a constitutional provision is to ask what it meant at the time it was drafted and ratified to the framers and to their generation. He said the Heller case and the way we look at the Second Amendment reflects a vindication of originalism. So I wanted to look at the story going back to the beginning, as Justice Scalia would have us do, to understand how it evolved from then to now. And it turns out that, and the reason this is called a biography, is that we have changed the way we look at the Second Amendment over and over again throughout American history. As with just about any constitutional provision, the way each generation looks at it afresh and decides what it means. And the way we decide, it turns out, is not due to some pristine constitutional text, but due to the push and pull, the rough and tumble of advocacy, of argument, of political organizing, and public debate. That was the story of the whole Constitution, and it turned out to be the story in many interesting and surprising ways of the Second Amendment. I think surprising for liberals, surprising in some ways for liberals, for conservatives, for people who consider themselves gun rights advocates, for people who are concerned about gun safety and gun laws. One of the first surprises comes when you just look at the very beginning. My book starts at Lexington and Concord, 16 miles outside of Boston. The shot heard round the world when the American Minutemen, the well-regulated militias around Boston, took on the British Army, the Redcoats. It turns out that those militias were at the heart of what people were talking about, arguing about, and thinking about when they created that Second Amendment. Far from being a throat clearing, the way we sometimes imagine it might be now, the militias were something they passionately cared about. But those militias were not like anything we have now, not like anything we know. They're not the same as the National Guard. The militia back then in the colonial and revolutionary era was every adult man, eventually every adult white man, was in the militia from age 16 to 60. And they were required by law to own a gun, to keep it at home, and to bring it in for their military service. Very different level of civic engagement and compulsion than we would be accustomed to now. Why did they care about the militias so much? Well, they were their police force. They didn't have police. They were the way they kept order. They were a military force. But even more than that, they cared passionately. It was at the center of their political philosophy because they believed those militias were a bulwark against tyranny, against the dangers they saw from what were called a standing army. A standing army, like the Redcoats, like the British Army, was a professional army, paid soldiers at the command of the king. And they saw that as authoritarianism in the making. So when the American Revolution began, it was the citizen soldiers of the militias with their guns, their personal guns, kept at home, squaring off against that tyrannical, terrifying thing, the standing army. The revolution unfolded. The militias didn't do so well, but they were still at the heart of what people cared about. We actually built an army ourselves, the Continental Army, led, of course, by George Washington. You all know this story. After the revolution was over, the British military force sailed away, and our nation, our 13 independent states, began to move toward what we would now consider a failed state. And so many of the leading men of that period, many of whom had served in the army, not in the militias, went behind closed doors and wrote a new document, the Constitution, at the Constitutional Convention, that thrust unmistakably toward a much stronger central government. And when it was released, when the Constitution was released, it sparked this remarkable, fierce debate, probably the greatest debate in American history, over whether to ratify it or not. And so many people were afraid, opposed the Constitution because it created too strong a central government. And there were many, many arguments they had, but one of their big fears was, in fact, that it would have an army. And that army, that new strong central government, would crush those 13 state militias. That fear led directly to the writing and enactment of the Second Amendment. As you know, to get the Constitution ratified through the states, eventually it got ratified, but the states sent in dozens of recommendations for amendments on all kinds of different topics. James Madison eventually, who was against there being a Bill of Rights. In modern terms, we would say he was against the Bill of Rights before he was for it. He had written the Constitution more than anyone else. He'd led the fight for it, arguing it didn't need to be amended. Then he had to run for Congress in the first election. He had a gerrymandered district before there was such a thing. And he had to do the first great flip-flop in American history to win the swing vote of the district, who were the Baptists. Now the Southern Baptists are a reliably conservative vote. Then they were the religious dissidents, and they felt they were oppressed by the Episcopalians of the district. To win their vote, he came out for a religious freedom amendment. He won by 339 votes. Then he had to go to Congress. He proposed 20 amendments, 20 amendments on topics ranging from the size of a congressional district to congressional pay to the Fifth Amendment in his list was this one, was what we now know as the Second Amendment. So what did they mean? What were they thinking about when they wrote that amendment? There is the fog of history. It's convoluted. You left Robin in her reading of it left out all those confusing commas. We, of course, can't fully know what was in their minds. But it is a striking thing and surprising to me when I read through the history this. In the notes that Madison took, the authoritative notes at the Constitutional Convention, in the records of the ratification conventions, with scattered exceptions, in the debate in the United States Congress, on the floor of the Congress, about the Second Amendment, there's not a word about individual gun ownership for self-protection or hunting or any of the things that consume us today as we intensely wrestle with these issues of gun rights. They were talking about, they were thinking about the militia. In fact, Madison's proposal for the Second Amendment had a conscientious objector clause. It said, if you have religious scruples about bearing arms, you don't have to do your military service in person. That's an actual quote. Again, remember, the militias were not like anything we have now. They were private citizens who owned guns at home. So I'm asked all the time, well, what was it? Was it an individual right, or was it the militias? Give us the answer. The answer, as far as I can tell, is it's both, and it's neither. It was an individual right at that time to fulfill the civic duty to serve in the militia. To the framers, our question would make no sense. Just like to us, their answer makes no sense and doesn't really give us all that much guidance. Now, I want to be really clear. There were plenty of guns in the United States. There were plenty of guns. I would say, just ask Alexander Hamilton, right? They had guns. Americans expected to be able to defend themselves. They expected to have the right to self-defense. It was handed down from England through common law, through court decisions. The great jurist Blackstone wrote about it. But at the same time that they had that right of self-defense, there was a web of gun safety and gun control laws from the beginning. At the time of the Second Amendment, it was illegal to keep a loaded gun in your home in Boston for safety reasons. You couldn't fire a gun inside the city limits of Philadelphia or in other cities. There were all kinds of restrictions on who could own weapons to make sure that dangerous people couldn't have guns. So you had to, Tories, for example, were prohibited from having weapons in a lot of places. So from the beginning, there were guns and gun rights and gun responsibility simultaneously. And then something funny happened. The militias vanished. That world vanished. The country changed. We grew more individualistic. We moved west. People just stopped showing up for their militia duty. And as the country grew, the idea that it was an individual right became more common. And at the same time, always there was a web of strong gun laws and gun safety laws. In the book, I describe a wonderful photograph from Dodge City, the archetypal frontier town from the 1880s. And the photo is amazing. It looks like a movie set. I mean, it looks like you're on the Universal Studios tour. You know, it's a dusty main street, and there's the saloon doors and the hitching posts, and it says a sign in the middle of the street. It says, "Welcome to Dodge City. Firearms strictly prohibited." Dodge City. That was the way it was. And over and over again, Americans made these decisions at the ballot box and legislatures to balance gun rights and gun safety laws. And the courts stayed out. Repeatedly, the Supreme Court declined to rule or ruled that the Second Amendment didn't protect an individual right. By 1991, this was the standard view. Warren Burger, the former Chief Justice of the United States, rock-ribbed conservative appointed by Richard Nixon, he said the idea that the Second Amendment recognizes an unlimited individual right to gun ownership is, quote, a fraud on the public. That was Warren Burger. That was the conventional wisdom. So what happened? What changed? That comes to the second surprise. What changed was the role of the NRA. Now, the National Rifle Association, you all know, it's been around for a long time. It's been around since the end of the Civil War. It was created by former Union officers who were worried about poor marksmanship by the troops. And it focused on training and marksmanship and military preparedness. And eventually it spoke for hunters and sportsmen. It didn't love gun control laws, but it didn't really oppose them very strongly either. It actually testified when they testified for the first federal gun laws in the 1930s, and a member of Congress asked them, well, gee, can you think of any constitutional provision that might be touched on here? And they said, we haven't given that matter any thought. That was the NRA for a long time. Well, what happened? What happened was the 1960s, and even more significantly, the 1970s. We all know about the massive sweeping social changes that roiled the country in the 60s, but it turns out that the reaction to the 60s, the backlash in the 70s, has had in some ways an even bigger impact and has created the political world we live in now. In 1977, the NRA indicated that it was going to move its headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Colorado to signal a further retreat from politics. Hard to believe, though, that is. At their annual meeting that year, it is known still as the Revolt at Cincinnati. 1,000 activists showed up, voted out the old leadership, voted in new leadership that was much more dogmatic, much more doctrinaire, and that refashioned this sportsman's organization into a constitutional crusade around the Second Amendment and around the idea that it reflected a unlimited individual right. So that now, today, when you go to the NRA headquarters in Washington, outside Washington, you go in the lobby, and there on the wall, not surprisingly, is the Second Amendment in the big letters, in pride of place, except you have to look closely. They've edited it. They actually edited out the first half. They have two dots. They don't even have three dots, two dots. So that's the NRA now. And what the NRA did was it waged, and its allies, a classic textbook constitutional campaign over three decades for change. They started with scholarship, some of it good, about what the people of the colonial era actually thought their rights were. Some of it, I argue in the book, very flimsy. Surprisingly so. One example that was interesting especially is you can go to many law review articles and find a quote from Thomas Jefferson saying, one loves to possess arms, though one hopes never to have to use them. This is shown in these law review articles to be what the framers thought the Second Amendment meant. Wow. You can go to these law review articles. You can go on the NRA website today. It's there. But you can also go on the internet and find out what Jefferson actually said. He was writing to George Washington. He said, remember that controversial decision I made as Secretary of State, and I sent you those letters from that? Could you send them back to me? I think I'm going to get attacked. One loves to possess arms, though one hopes never to have to use them. I want to have those letters in case someone writes an article criticizing me. That's what Jefferson was saying, but you can still go to the law review articles and see that as the proof. So they backed scholarship. They moved public opinion so that eventually it became the consensus view in the public that the Second Amendment reflected an individual right. They moved the organs of government so that the Justice Department switched its view. And then, and only then, they went to court. And so that when that case was heard in 2008, the ruling fell like a ripe apple from a tree. That's the classic way we Americans make constitutional change. That's the way civil rights happened. That's the way marriage equality is sweeping across the country. That's the way my organization, the Brennan Center, works on voting to protect voting rights. They understood, the gun rights advocates understood, that to win in the court of law, you first have to win in the court of public opinion. And that's what they did. What happened then, very quickly, was a third surprise. What happened then was this. If you strip away the finery, the pretensions of originalism in Scalia's opinion, it actually said, yes, there's an individual right, but as with any individual right, there are limitations. He even listed some. And then dozens and dozens of courts have heard dozens and dozens of lawsuits ever since, all over the country, challenging existing gun laws. And overwhelmingly, those laws have been upheld. Overwhelmingly, under these new Supreme Court doctrine, those laws have been upheld. Yes, the courts say there's an individual right, but society, too, has a right to protect itself. There is a compelling public and governmental interest in strong gun laws. Now, we don't know how it's all going to play out. The Supreme Court has not spoken again. I quote in the book Justice Robert Jackson, who said the Supreme Court is not final because it's infallible. It's infallible because it's final. The court has especially not looked at the question of carrying weapons outside the home and where the right is in terms of carrying weapons. But they've also worked, they have not chosen to take the cases that they could have taken, even as recently as last month. So we don't know how it's going to play out. There's a big case in California now that could be an important case, but we don't know how it's going to play out. What is the lesson from all of this? I'm asked frequently by people who are very concerned about the trend, who are very desirous of stronger gun laws or of at least stopping the slide toward Second Amendment fundamentalism that could really deflect common sense fixes that ought to be the kind of thing everybody can agree on. What I say is, look, you know, what the NRA and its allies did is entirely in the mainstream of how Americans make constitutional change. And if you want constitutional change, one needs to be patient. One needs to understand that above all else, we the people, the public, in our minds and in our collective mind, decide what the Constitution means. And I'm very fond of something that a great constitutional thinker, Abraham Lincoln, said during one of the earlier great debates over slavery in the first Lincoln-Douglas debate of 1858. He said, with public sentiment, anything is possible. Without public sentiment, nothing is possible. Consequently, he said, he who molds public sentiment has more power than a legislator or a judge, because they make it possible for those legislators and judges to act. That's been the story on this provision in the Constitution, and indeed on most provisions of the Constitution. It's going to be the debate going forward, and a debate perhaps we'll join in tonight. So thank you so much for your interest.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's Law School and author of the new book, The Second Amendment, A Biography. I'm Mark Fulman of Mother Jones Magazine, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, as well as catch up with them on Facebook and Twitter and on YouTube. So, Michael, in the book, you talk quite a bit about how politics has shaped the current debate about guns and gun policy and what the court's done, the major effect that the Heller decisions had. And curious to hear a little bit more from you about that and how you see the current political climate shaping what's happening both in the courts but also with policy at the state and local level. In the book, you tell a remarkable story about a policy fight in Newtown the year prior to the horrible event there.
You're exactly right that when the Supreme Court issues a ruling, even a ruling as ultimately limited in its reach as the Heller ruling was, and there was another one 2 years later that applied Heller to the states through the 14th Amendment, when the Supreme Court speaks, it speaks in a very loud voice, and its arguments boom throughout the country, and they take on a validity and a life of their own that has a communicative effect well beyond what any footnote or any narrow legal holding has. That has been the case, I would suggest, with the Supreme Court's embrace of the individual right. You now hear the Second Amendment as a synonym for guns, as a synonym for the gun culture, which used to be something people talked about as hunting, and you need to understand the difference between rural and urban life and that sort of thing. It is now rooted in and revolves around a very fervent belief in an individual right protected against any intrusion of any kind by government and brandished over and over again. And it was really striking to learn that in Newtown, Connecticut, in the year before that horrific shooting, the big local issue was that people, and of course it's a rural area and there's a lot of deer hunting and that sort of thing going on, but people were taking to the hills around Newtown and firing enhanced bullets and blowing up propane tanks and using assault weapons late at night near schools and all these kind of crazy things that were going on. And so the town council, and this is a town, by the way, where one of the major gun lobbying groups is headquartered. So it's not a gun grabber's paradise by any means. The town council wanted to pass some zoning laws saying, well, you know, you can't shoot past a certain hour at night in a residential neighborhood. It was non-controversial, and then hundreds of activists started showing up saying that their Second Amendment right was going to be trampled on. And the member of the town council, and the town backed away, and we know of the member of the town council who was the chair of the committee because she was the heroic librarian at the school who saved the lives of many students and teachers. It was this kind of startling window on sort of the world of Second Amendment fundamentalism at a local level.
And the way it's affecting policy in the current environment.
When you can proclaim passionately a constitutional right, it tends to trump a lot of other discussions that one might have.
Mm-hmm. And what's your perspective on that particular group in the political landscape, the very vocal, aggressive side of the pro-gun rights debate, and how they are affecting it? You know, I think a lot of people are interested in the question of, you know, who's really in control of this debate and where is it headed? Certainly, they're a very loud voice. I've seen that in much of my reporting as well, and they get a lot of attention for it, but does that mean that they're being effective?
Well, they're two different questions, I would suggest. When I go around the country, and I've been talking for almost 2 months now about this topic since the book was published, one of the most common questions I get asked is, well, aren't the gun companies really behind the NRA, or aren't they paying for a lot of this, or does the NRA hold sway and have its power over legislators because of its campaign money or political action committee money? My sense, and I know what I know from reading your reporting and that of other journalists, my sense is that's not the case, that while the gun manufacturers lately have begun funding gun rights groups, that what really lends power to their work is the passion of the gun owners and the passion of their members who are willing to vote as a single issue. And who, it's the classic political scientist's conundrum of, you know, a narrower group of people having more passion and thus being able to hold sway. Last year when the Congress, in the wake of Newtown, was debating the bipartisan Manchin-Toomey bill to strengthen the background check system, you know, something like 90% of the public supported it. And in fact, it did get a majority of the Senate because it lost because of the filibuster, which is a different topic. But the power of the NRA came from the passion of its members in helping to sustain that filibuster. Not so much because it violated the Second Amendment, because people couldn't really argue that too much with a straight face, but more arguments about paperwork and that sort of thing.
And the NRA, to a great degree, has worked to stoke that passion, right, through both its messaging and through its legal work, as you described.
Well, the NRA now has a very ample legal department, and it is bringing cases all over the country. And it's kind of an interesting inversion of what one might have argued was the way liberals might have done it in the past. They are really prone to going to court and to trying to get judges to overturn the laws passed by democratically elected bodies. And I realize I sound like somebody talking, you know, in the 1960s in that way. And it's an interesting inversion. But right now they've got a very aggressive legal operation, but they've been not particularly successful. I mean, something Robin's organization keeps track, and I believe at least 95% of the cases, the gun laws have been upheld. In fact, gun rights advocates have decried the consensus, the emerging consensus among courts. They said it is akin to massive resistance, which was what the South did after Brown versus Board of Education. It may well just be that the courts have found the kind of proper happy medium to balance the rights and the responsibilities.
Hmm. I'm going to take a question from the audience here. It follows that nicely, I think. A lot of people see a very big, if not extreme, cultural gap now in our country on this issue. What's your view of how that will affect this debate going forward, and in terms of laws changing or not, And do you think it's possible to deal with the gun violence problem in the United States, which is very significant, as we all know, through laws, through changing laws?
Well, there is emphatically a cultural gap. Folks who live in rural areas have a very different relationship with their firearms than people who live in cities. There's a hunting culture, and those of us who live in cities have to be very respectful of that. Interestingly, the social trends and the demographic changes suggest that some of the intensity may diminish over time, because while, first of all, there are close to 300 million guns in the United States, that's a startlingly high number. It's much more per person than other industrial or developed countries. More and more people, more and more guns, but fewer and fewer people have guns. The ranks of gun owners has actually dropped pretty considerably over time. Fewer people hunt, fewer people have been in the military. The rural areas are shrinking, and so the demographic base of gun ownership is actually shrinking in the country. I think that that does suggest that there are some solutions, and many of them are not really in the realm of, quote, gun laws or gun control laws. There are technological fixes that, again, I don't think trample or risk trampling on a Second Amendment right. Among other things, the Second Amendment, now that the Supreme Court has emphatically proclaimed there to be a right, folks who are worried that their guns are going to be confiscated, generally speaking, don't have much to worry about. That line has been drawn, and perhaps that will help change the debate. But it does suggest that there are, as the generally speaking, gun violence has gone down, as well as the rest of crime, that there are solutions that could make a difference that don't touch on the Second Amendment at all. I was struck by something I saw after the book was done, that this year more people will be killed in the United States by guns than by cars. Now, at one level, that's a shocking and dismaying statistic. 33,000 people killed by firearms in the United States. And again, that is a much higher level than other countries, a much, much higher level. But what's interesting is, why are so few people killed by cars? That number has actually been dropping a lot over time. That's what's knew about that statistic. Well, what happened? They didn't confiscate the cars. They didn't come in black helicopters and take away your right to drive. They made cars safer. They raised the drinking age. They lowered the speed limit. They put in airbags. They put in seat belts. They put in all these other technological things in the cars to make them safer. And there are certainly things in the area of guns and firearms that could keep them out of the hands of children, make them harder to use, keep them out of the hands of the wrong people, such as smart guns or trace bullets and all kinds of other things. And my worry is that Second Amendment fundamentalism and a rush to the courthouse could chill the kind of technological innovation that could make a real difference.
Mm-hmm. Another audience question here on a related note. Essentially, the impact of the Heller decision, how extensive do you see it being? Is there the possibility that the court will one day revisit that decision and possibly overturn it or change it? Or are we in a post-Heller world here forward?
Nobody, as Yogi Berra said, it's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. And so I would not want to make such a prediction. But I don't imagine that the Heller case is going to be overturned, at least not anytime soon. It's a very popular decision. It's entirely possible for those who want stronger gun laws to have those laws upheld under Heller and its regime. And, you know, the Supreme Court, having proclaimed something a right, very rarely goes back and says, no, it isn't after all. I think people feel uncomfortable about that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I point out to my friends that had the Heller decision gone the other way, one might have seen a constitutional amendment to rewrite the Second Amendment to be the way it now is interpreted, or even in a more unregulated sense. So I don't imagine that overturning Heller, but I think that there will be many, many instances where there is going to need to be more clarity about what kinds of laws are and are not constitutionally passing muster. Again, it turns out that just about everything that's on the books right now has been upheld as constitutional.
perhaps on a similar note, an equally long shot prospect recently, the retired Justice Stevens suggested that we should change the Second Amendment. Do you think that that's a possibility? And would it be a good idea?
Again, he urged several constitutional amendments. One of them was to say that only those people actively in the militia had the right to bear arms. And I, you know, in a way, I kind of think that there aren't those militias right now. So it's not such a serious proposal to suggest that. And you know, these debates and these cultural gaps go back to the very beginning. It's in looking at the debate over the Constitution and the fear that people had that led to the Second Amendment. There were urban and rural divides even then, although it was between the one state where the ratification fight, where people actually said, although they didn't say it in any official way, that there ought to be the individual right for hunting to be protected, was in Pennsylvania, and it was Western Pennsylvania backwoodsmen who didn't trust the urban sophisticates of Philadelphia, who were Quakers. It was striking to see how so many of the cultural divides were there then and now. Barack Obama was not the first urban politician to complain that Western Pennsylvanians, you know, cling to their guns and God, as he was quoted as saying in 2008. Mm-hmm. It goes back all the way to then.
Another good question from the audience. What do you see as the most effective way to change gun laws? And I think that you know, that question applies to either side of the issue, you know, regardless of where you fall on it politically. And again, how the politics as they exist now play into that.
So I think the most effective way is the way gun laws have been changed by both sides, by all sides, which is generally speaking not in the courthouse, but in the democratically elected branches of government and at the ballot box. Why is that better? Among the reasons why I think that's better is that given that the question of what the Second Amendment means really can't be answered by going back in a time machine and tapping James Madison on the shoulder and asking him what to do, given that we have had to kind of create our own balance at each era between gun rights and responsibilities and public interest, that kind of balancing really is done best by the legislature, by people who hear from all sides, by people who see organizing. And this is actually, if you look at the dissents in the Heller case, there were two of them. One was by Justice Stevens, and he, I'm a significant critic in this book. I shouldn't say significant, that would be, I'm an enthusiastic critic of the doctrine of originalism, in that knowing the original intent of the framers and reading the text is really important with any constitutional provision. But it's the beginning, not the end of the analysis. You have to ask, what happened then? What happened in the next two centuries? What happened? How did the country change? How did we read the provision all along? How do we balance these things all along? And Justice Stevens wrote a dissent that was an originalist dissent. It looked at the history and came to a very different conclusion from what Justice Scalia did. Justice Scalia, in his 64-page opinion, spent two of the 64 pages on the militias, which was what they were fighting about. And the rest was reading dictionaries from the 1700s and the 1800s and taking the words out of context. And I liken it to kind of a really ambitious Scrabble player trying to prove that triple score word really exists. You know, he didn't actually look at the debates much of the constitutional of the Congress, for example, as they wrote the Second Amendment. Justice Stevens did, but I thought had the better of the argument. But there was a third opinion, a dissent by Justice Breyer. Breyer said, "Look, let's stipulate it's an individual right. What then? How are we going to decide? We know that we have limits on those rights. Well, how are we going to decide?" He said that he thought that the best decisions were a balance and that the best people to do the balance were the legislatures. That's how the NRA, in fact, and its allies, in fact, have made the most progress. During the last 20 years, there's been, in some ways, hiding in plain sight, a sweep of new laws loosening the restrictions on carrying guns, We all know about stand your ground laws in Florida and elsewhere, preempting, going to state legislatures and preempting longstanding laws that cities have with their special and unusual circumstances in cities, preempting those laws so that they can't be enforced. And that was all done by gun rights advocates, not in the courts, but at the ballot box. So I would say to both, I would say that's how they're going to continue whatever success they have. And that's how the reawakened gun control and gun safety community and gun safety groups are going to do it. I mentioned that, you know, I worked for President Clinton in the 1990s. Congress passed the Brady Bill and an assault weapons ban. But in the intervening years, there really was a dearth of activity by those who wanted stronger gun laws. Now, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' group, Mayor Bloomberg's group, and a whole host of other new and well-funded groups have joined the fray. So along with the National Coalition on Gun Violence and others who've been doing great, great work. So, you know, I think it's just going to be a continuing push. And again, it doesn't have to touch on the Second Amendment. In the wake of the shooting in California at University of California at Santa Barbara, much attention was turned to the role of mental health. And people rightly said, well, you know, we need to have a mental health system that works. One way you make it work is keeping guns out of the hands who people shouldn't have them. And there are a lot of innovative proposals for how to improve the mental health system that, again, deal with the thing everyone ought to agree on, which is people, some people shouldn't have guns.
It's interesting, too, because with that and with things like, you know, the overwhelming support for universal background checks that we see in national polls, you know, to your point about public opinion being in a lot of cases what moves first or what then compels politics and the courts to change, it's interesting that that hasn't yet been effective in a sense in creating change or influencing decisions. What do you make of that?
Well, we don't know. It hasn't yet, but you know, there's a broad view that isn't always as intensely held, and the question is what kindles that level of intensity. For NRA members, it's a sense of their personal empowerment, their personal rights, their personal attitude toward government and central authority, cultural beliefs. It's very much a part of who they are in their lifestyle, and that isn't really the case necessarily on all sides of the issue. But I would say this. I think that there may be a silent majority, especially among women, on a lot of these issues. You all probably are familiar with the open carry movement in Texas, where in an effort to make the case that there will be loosened laws on carrying guns, people are taking assault weapons into fast food restaurants or Target stores or other places. And it is it's sparked the videos have gone viral. The cell phones have been wielded as weapons in this debate. And they're really striking. And even the NRA on their website said, this is really weird, you know, and counterproductive. And then the person who wrote that blog post was never heard from again. They pulled the post off. But it really is. And I would not be surprised if many people, especially many women, look at that and have a very different reaction than one might expect. Does that turn into votes? Does it turn into legislative victories? You know, this is a long slog. These things tend to go in spasms. It used to be assassinations, political violence. The first urban gun laws at the beginning of the 20th century, the Revolver Acts in 9 states were prompted by the attempted assassination of the mayor of New York. A lot of the more recent gun laws were by other assassinations. Now it's mass shootings. But there tends to be a spasm of remorse and horror and legislating, and then people forget about it. This is an endless debate that's going to go on, and people who want stronger laws need to be at it for the long term.
Mm-hmm. And yet an endless debate much more contemporaneously, right? I mean, you talk about in the book how for, you know, roughly 200 years there was really nothing happening on this issue, and now we live in this time where there's intense debate and entrenched ideology and change going on. Maybe you can talk for a minute a little bit about the reaction to your book from the NRA and the gun lobby, which is interesting on that note.
Yeah, well, so, you know, some some folks who don't like the book's gotten I've been very pleased with the reception, even from all, people who don't agree necessarily with the political conclusion. And there are certainly strong and valid questions about whether the notion of the individual rights and the colonial era are properly weighed and so forth. I've been surprised by one reaction that I have gotten, which is I know the NRA talked about this, and I've had the chance to share the podium with some of the top lawyers who brought these cases. And they say, no, nothing has changed. There was no change, no significant change in the way the Second Amendment was seen. It was always seen this way. And in fact, the 9-0 Supreme Court case in 1939 saying that the Second Amendment only applied to militias, that's actually completely consistent with the recent cases. And that was I was on a podium with the gentleman who argued the Heller case, and the moderator finally turned to him and said, you know, Mr. Waldman has accused you of being the Thurgood Marshall of the gun rights movement. Why are you denying that? And I wouldn't want to guess what he was thinking at that moment, but that was the position they were taking. I also heard something really interesting recently, a tape of a commercial from the 1980s. And it said, the Second Amendment, it's ignored. Judges ignore it. It's not, scholars belittle it. It's not taught in law schools. It doesn't have an impact. If we don't change this, freedom's flame will flicker out. I'm Charlton Heston. Please join the NRA and help us change the way we see the Second Amendment, basically. And that's exactly what they did, whatever they say now.
Mm-hmm. It's a great example that underscores how long they've been at this and what their strategy's been.
It was three decades almost to the year from that revolt in Cincinnati to the Supreme Court embracing what was then seen as a fringe constitutional view. And again, if you agree with them or not, that is how constitutional change happens in America, and always will.
And in that sense, I think, you know, I hear a lot when I talk with folks on the other side of the issue that, you know, there's this kind of common narrative about how, you know, because Congress did nothing last April, it's over. The NRA won, you know, end of story. But in fact, that's just a blip on the clock in this type of policy debate.
It's chapter 47 of the story. And similarly, there was, while Congress did nothing, in several states, in New York and in Connecticut and in Colorado, laws dealing with assault weapons were passed. In Colorado, there was a backlash to that, and two of the state senators, were recalled or were about to be recalled. Right now, in Washington State, there's a ballot measure that would strengthen the state background check system. I think that the greatest bit of power that the NRA has is not the sense that they have everybody's support, but that you can't cross them. And once they lose something, the politics of it can start to shift pretty dramatically. At least that's the way these things tend to go.
Hmm. One other question here from the audience. Looking ahead, you know, given that it's hard to make predictions, as you say, where do you see the broader legal fight going, and what might we possibly see at the Supreme Court next on the guns issue? And in the context of the current Supreme Court that we have, what do you think might happen?
Well, the Heller case was the first, but obviously not the last, of these sharply divided, ideologically distinct 5-4 rulings. It was followed by Citizens United, by Shelby County. They came within one vote and a whisker of striking down the Affordable Care Act. On a interpretation of the Commerce Clause that would have knocked down in the end dozens and dozens and dozens of laws. Shelby County was the case that gutted the Voting Rights Act to some of the opinions in the most recent court. This Supreme Court is tends to be more ideologically divided and more predictable these days based on the partisan affiliation of who appointed the judges, the justices, than any other court in the country. Having said that, the court has declined repeatedly to take another gun case. Most recently, as I mentioned, there's the question of what the Second Amendment right is outside the home. Both the Heller case and the McDonald case, which applied it to the states, dealt with the relatively narrow issue of whether you had the right to keep a handgun in the home to defend yourself. Now, about as far from what the framers were talking about with your musket in military service as it's possible to be, but that was also something probably people have much less trouble with than anything else, you know. But what about outside the home? What about concealed weapons? What about open carrying of weapons? The Supreme Court has not ruled on that, and even as recently as last month, there was a chance to rule on a case from New Jersey, and they declined to do so, and the federal ruling upholding New Jersey's very, very strict law was allowed to stand. Now, why doesn't the court take this case or these other cases? We don't know. Maybe there's four justices on one side, four justices on another side, and as on so many other things, they don't know where Justice Kennedy's going to go. Or maybe the court is comfortable with the consensus. They want to see how it plays out, and in fact are perhaps as struck as we are by the kind of unanimity of approach that has evolved in the courts. So we don't know for sure. But I do think it would be a mistake to just look at the courts. This has not been something that was principally a constitutional litigation issue for the first 2.5 centuries of the country, and I doubt it will be going forward.
As you also talk about in the books, we've had this whole history of traumatic events setting off this debate over and over. A lot of people talk about Newtown being a transformative moment, perhaps even more so than anything that preceded it. Moving away from the courts and looking more at the legislative landscape, do you think that's true? Do you think that we're in a different kind of setting now for potential legislative change?
Well, more than in the past decade or two, but it's not clear how much so compared to other periods in American history. Notably, this week, in today's Washington Post on the website, it turns out that a gun debate is about to erupt in the Senate that nobody saw coming. There's a bill that, according to the coverage, that would make it easier to hunt in national parks. Not a particularly controversial thing, actually, in rural areas. Supposedly, the Senate leadership scheduled this to give some of the Democrats from states like North Carolina something to vote for. Well, not surprisingly, now Ted Cruz wants to introduce legislation to allow people to bring guns into federal buildings, post offices, and to overturn the ban on assault weapons in Washington, D.C., and pro-gun safety folks are saying, well, we shouldn't pass this unless there's an opportunity to do something about background checks and other things. So the attempt at a little bill didn't quite go the way they'd hoped, and I wouldn't be surprised if they pull the whole thing off the floor rather than risk a major cultural conflagration this close to an election.
There are many political issues that are extremely, ideologically driven in terms of the way the debate goes. Guns seems to be near the top of the list, if not at the top. What do you see as a way to get past that in the discussion of this issue, whether with respect to legislation or the courts, policy making? I think for people who focus on this, it's just so difficult to get past that sometimes in the way that people talk about it.
Yeah, it's very polarized. It's very doctrinaire, and that's a relatively new development, too. It used to be, for example, John Dingell, just recently retired from Congress. He was one of the principal supporters of the NRA in Congress. He was a Democrat. It used to be also that when I worked for President Clinton, and he came from Arkansas, of course, he was very proud of having taken on the NRA in Arkansas. He used to talk about a confrontation he had with the NRA lobbyist in front of the State House. But he was very focused, very understanding at that point of the hunting culture in Arkansas. It was a state where half the people had a hunting license. And he used to brag that no hunter lost their gun after the Brady Bill passed or the assault weapons ban. I'm not entirely sure that I know that there is a a broad swath of NRA members, as there were then, who were in fact supportive, much more supportive than the leadership of the group, of common sense gun laws. I think that this has become much more of an ideological issue. It's very much bound up in fear of the federal government, perhaps of fear of President Obama, of cultural concerns, of libertarian distrust of public authority. The Heller case was actually not brought by the NRA. It was brought by somebody who chairs the Cato Institute board, the libertarian organization. And it really spoke to a much more ideological sense of individual freedom and fear of government. And so I don't know that I see that changing very much, and I'm at a bit of a loss to see the way toward finding that common sense coalition that sometimes has been visible in the past.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School and author of the new book, The Second Amendment, a Biography. I think we have time for a couple more questions. What do you see personally as perhaps the single most important policy change that we could have to deal with the gun violence problem, assuming that you don't think we have the perfect policies in place at this point?
You know, I don't pretend to be an expert on gun policy and on the answers to those questions. I guess I would suggest that a lot of the answers seem to come from things that don't touch on the core Second Amendment right. When you look at the drop in crime in the United States, it's been really dramatic. It's one of the great social facts of recent years, and very few people talk about it, and really we don't fully understand how it happened. But anybody who lives in the city and remembers what it was like 20, 30 years ago knows that it's been a massive, massive change. What caused the drop in violence? We don't fully know. But we think that it was things such as policing and more police and a whole host of other factors. Similarly, what can deal with these gun issues? Well, as I mentioned, there are technological fixes. Smart guns are a type of gun that recognize the owner, and that would keep guns in many ways out of the wrong hands. I used to be somewhat skeptical, just in the common sense way of, gee, well, I can sort of see how that would be rather cumbersome to try to have something like that, until I got an iPhone 5, which recognizes my thumbprint much faster than any other way I've ever turned on an electronic device. It turns out not to be cumbersome at all. I would suggest that a lot of the answers come from things like stronger mental health laws, technological fixes, better policing and more policing, that don't really go near, you know, confiscating this weapon or that weapon.
You've written some about how powerful the constitutional argument is in this debate. Do you see that changing at any point? Is there a way around that, in a sense, going back to what we were talking about with just the intense ideological entrenchment that we face with this issue?
Well, we Americans, of course, revere our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence, and rightly so. When you go to the National Archives, you see the line snaking around that grand hall, and we treat those documents like religious relics. And that's kind of one of the things that talk about American exceptionalism. That is what is distinct about our country. We don't have a king. We don't have a common ethnic stock. We have those documents. And so I think that the NRA and gun rights advocates have been very wise in seizing the constitutional high ground. But I think that it's important to understand what, in fact, that constitutional high ground is and what the right really is and how it really is a limited right and always has been. And so in writing the book, I wanted to understand the history, but I do think that the history is a more complex history than many people probably expect. Complex in a whole bunch of different ways. One thing we haven't talked about is the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, as you know, was ratified after the Civil War. And one of the purpose of the 14th Amendment was to protect, in the immediate terms, to protect the former slaves who were being terrorized in the South by white vigilantes. And one of the purposes that some of the framers of the 14th Amendment had was, in fact, to make sure that those former slaves could get guns, could have access to guns. Now, it's a more complex story than all of that. First of all, they were in militias, too. There were Republican Party militias and Democratic Party militias. And even then, the very people who believed that that was what they were doing, when they did it, it wasn't clear if they were saying that African Americans and whites just had to be treated the same, or whether they were giving some kind of natural right of gun ownership. But they believed strongly in gun control laws, so that the Reconstruction governments that enforced the 14th Amendment had very strict restrictions, for example, on carrying weapons for blacks and whites. So it's a kind of complicated story, but even there, there are surprises and constitutional dimensions that, properly understood, can lead us toward a less doctrinaire and a less divided view of these issues.
Our thanks to Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School and author of the new book, The Second Amendment, A Biography. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and online. I'm Mark Fulman of Mother Jones Magazine, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.